오늘 제가 모셔온 스페셜 게스트는 바로 말콤 글래드웰입니다. 말콤 글래드웰은 2000년대 초반에 아웃라이어, 그 개가 본 것은 같은 책을 써서 사회학자들이나 심리학자들이 하는 실험이 진짜 우리 삶에 유용하게 적용될 수 있다는 걸 보여준 분이죠. 가장 임팩트 있던 책이 제 생각에 남아 더 티핑 포인트라는 책이 아니었을까 생각이 돼요. 더 티핑 포인트에서 말콤 글래드웰은 몇 명의 창의적인 사람들의 머릿속에서 나온 새로운 생각이 어떻게 눈덩이처럼 불어나서 세상을 바꾸게 되는지 그 경위를 설명을 했고요. 바이럴이라는 단어가 아마 그 책으로부터 사람들에게 인지되지 않았나 생각이 됩니다. 그 이후로 페이스북이나 인스타그램, 트위터 같은 회사들이 나오면서 아이디어나 새로운 유행이 퍼지는 것을 사람들이 눈으로 확인할 수 있게 되었고, 또 아마존 같은 회사들이 순식간에 어마어마한 기업으로 성장하는 걸 보면서 티핑포인트는 아마 인터넷의 시대를 이해하기 위한 하나의 프레임워크로서 사람들이 꼭 읽어야 되는 필독서로 인지가 되었던 것 같아요. 그런데 티핑 포인트 25주년을 기념해서 말콤 글래드웰이 The Revenge of the Tipping Point, 티핑 포인트의 복수, 한국어 제목은 티핑 포인트의 설계자들이라는 책을 냈습니다. 전에 티핑 포인트는 이 티핑 포인트의 긍정적인 면에 포커스를 했다면 Revenge of the Tipping Point에서는 끊임없이 바이럴 효과를 통해서 주류와 비주류가 엎치락 뒤치락하는 현상이 우리 심리 속에서 우리 사회 안에 어떤 스트레스를 주고 있는지를 묘사한 책이어서 2025년 이 격동의 시대를 이해하는 데 꼭 필요한 책이라고 생각해서 소개해보려고 합니다. 특히 한국인들이 관심을 가지고 있는 학군지의 장단점이라든지 독일의 역사인식 문제 같은 내용을 통해서 이런 이야기를 하기 때문에 많은 분들이 더 재밌게 시청할 수 있으실 것이라고 생각합니다.
You took the world by storm 25 years ago when you wrote The Tipping Point. 25 years later, you decided to write sort of a sequel to the book called The Revenge of the Tipping Point. Why did you decide to revisit the ideas from The Tipping Point quarter of a century later? And why the revenge in the title? I mean, you could have called it anything like The Return of the Tipping Point or Tipping Point Strikes Back or Tipping Point The End Game. But you picked a very sort of a rousing word, Revenge of the Tipping Point. So why the choice?
In my first book, I viewed social epidemics very positively. And this time around, I was much more taken by the ways in which they can be used for less than ideal ends. I was a little bit more interested this time around in the dark side. So it seemed like, you know, the phenomenon I was celebrating 25 years ago, now I was kind of reconsidering.
And I think the dark side is evident in the veil you lift on the origin of the word, the tipping point, or rather the tip point as it was then called. And the origin of the word is actually quite dark.
Yeah, in the 1950s in the United States, there was this extraordinary phenomenon, which was that in response to African Americans moving into major urban areas all across the country, you know, a lot of Black people had moved up from rural areas in the South to northern cities, to big cities, and had done well enough that they had started to, they wanted to buy homes and move into good neighborhoods. And as they tried to buy houses in neighborhoods, white people who had been there for generations were so terrified that they started to flee. And the tip point refers to how many Black people had to move into a neighborhood before everyone else, all the white people, would decide to leave. And, you know, there was, so what you would observe in these neighborhoods was if a couple of Black people moved in, the remaining white people were fine. They wouldn't terrify, they wouldn't leave, they wouldn't sell their house in a panic. But once the number of Black people reached the tip point, which was somewhere between 25% and a third, then everyone left all at once. And so realtors were, and neighborhoods were very much aware of this in the 50s. It was a very real phenomenon for them. And if a neighborhood could keep the number of Black people below that kind of magical point, it could stay intact. But if it didn't, it would fall apart. So the idea at the core of the tipping point is that small numbers of an outsider group don't change the culture of the larger institution or community that they're joining. But once outsiders reach this magical moment, somewhere between a quarter and a third, then they do make an impact on the culture of the overall community. They change it dramatically. Schools in America, elite schools, have been very much aware of this phenomenon for years. And back in the 20s, when children of Jewish immigrants were finding their way, were in the same position that many Asian immigrants are today. They took academics very seriously. They began to qualify for elite schools in large numbers. And schools very consciously sought to limit the numbers of Jewish students to keep them below the tipping point. They did not want to have anything close to 25% or 30% Jewish students. And the same thing is happening today with Asians. They are, the lawsuit you're referring to, which went all the way to the Supreme Court, very clearly established that elite schools were going out of their way to place an artificial limit on the number of Asian students they would admit. And they wanted to keep the Asian students below the tipping point because they did not want the culture of the schools to change in a way that they imagined would be bad for the institution. Now, I think that is a ridiculous fear, but they wanted to keep Harvard the way Harvard has always been. And they felt if Asian students were above the tipping point, Harvard would change. I think intuitively, majorities, any group that's in the majority, is aware of threats from the outside and is aware that threats are proportionate to their numbers. And I think that fear is not entirely rational, because I think that as an outsider, an immigrant to America, I have no problem with America changing in response to immigration, but many native-born Americans do. And so I think this has been a kind of constant theme in any society that has been dominated by a homogeneous group for a long time.
이 비주류와 주류의 관계는 오늘날 세상을 이해하기에 정말 필수적으로 이해하는 것 중에 하나라고 저는 생각을 했습니다. 예를 들어서 한 10여 년 전까지만 해도 비주류 정치 사상이라고 생각되던 유럽과 미국의 일부 사상들이 주류 사상으로 떠오르면서 이런 나라들의 정치가 불안정해지는 걸 우리가 지켜봤고요. 또 그런 사상들이 주류 사상이 돼가는 과정에서 지금까지 우리가 당연시했던 세계의 경제를 지탱하고 있던 글로벌 서플라이 체인 같은 것도 공격의 대상이 되면서 지난 몇 달 동안에 미국을 비롯해서 전 세계 주식시장이 크게 흔들렸고 2025년 4월 초에는 우리나라 주식 사이드카가 발동될 정도로 심한 충격이 온 걸 우리가 몸소 경험을 했죠. 또 대다수의 과학자나 의료계에 종사하는 분들이 동의하지 않는 소수 의료 의견이 대중적으로 번져나가면서 미국까지 잘 사는 나라에서 20세기 초반에나 있었을 법한 홍역이라든지 수두 같은 것이 다시 유행하는 것을 보면서 주류 의견과 비주류 의견이 계속 엎치락뒤치락하는 모습을 우리가 실제로 보고 있고 그것이 우리 삶에 직접적인 영향을 끼치고 있습니다.
You talk about an interesting experiment. Everybody sort of intuitively feel, especially the groups in majority intuitively feel, like you said, that there is a tipping point where their cultural dominance will fritter away if there's more than a certain percentage of minority. But nobody thinks of that as being a specific number. And the most interesting part of your book was that you actually say there's a golden fourth and a golden third, where if there's between 25 to 33% of minority, then the environment or the culture of the whole group changes dramatically. And to arrive at this number, you cite an experiment involving names, people guessing what names that they're thinking of. Could you explain how this game works and why this game proves that 25% or 33% is the sort of the golden percentage?
So the anecdotally, people had observed for decades that something seemed to be happening between 25 and 30%. And so a communication scholar decided to try and do a kind of abstract test of it. And it was a simple naming game where he would match pairs of people and they would be shown a picture simultaneously and of a person, and they would have to guess what that person's name was. And what you do that, if you do that game, you do rounds and rounds and rounds of that game. And what you discover is that over time, weirdly, people start to agree on what the name of the person is. So if you show a picture of me to a large enough group of people, you know, I show two people independently guess what my name is, and then they, you know, the picture circulates to another pair and another pair and another pair. And you eventually consensus does emerge. What the experimenter did was to artificially structure that experiment so that he had a group of people who gave crazy names, who were instructed to give a crazy name after a consensus had been reached. And he wanted to know how many people who were advocating for a crazy name did it take before the group switched and everyone joined in and agreed on the crazy name. And the answer is it was about 25 or 30%. And it's a very I'm not describing the experiment very well because it's sort of complicated, but his point was it's an incredibly robust finding that if you have a consensus, disrupting the consensus does not require getting half of the group or more than half of the group to depart from this consensus. It only takes somewhere between a quarter and a third. Did more than a third of Russians back the communist revolution of 1919? I kind of doubt it. Were more than a third of Germans devoted to the Nazi Party in the 1930s? No, not particularly. Were did the in America there's been, you know, there was this revolution in the way people's willingness to accept gay marriage. That revolution starts not when half of Americans change their mind, but when something closer to a quarter or a third of Americans change their mind. I mean, I could sort of go on. I think that this is, it's safe to call this the norm, that change, when we get to a third of society kind of arguing against the orthodoxy crumbles. And that's the reason why human societies are as volatile as they are.
So when you see, for example, unorthodox political parties in Europe, like AfD in Germany, or the, I don't know what they call it now, but what they used to call the Front National in France, when those parties begin to sort of inch up, like from 15% to 18% to 20%, should we expect something like really major to happen when that number reaches 25%?
Yes. I mean, I think we should be aware that the impact of these, what seem like marginal groups, is going to be far larger than their numbers. That's, I think, the lesson of this.
이 책에 나오는 내용 중에 아이러니하게 한국의 현실과 굉장히 깊게 맞닿는 내용이 하나 있었는데요. 바로 학군지에 대한 내용이었어요. 말콤 글래드웰은 미국 같은 경우에는 학교를 주로 지역사회에서 구성하는 경우가 많기 때문에 상위권 중산층 직업을 가지고 있는 사람들끼리 모여서 범죄도 없고 살기 좋은 완벽한 동네를 형성하고 아이비리그 진학률이 매우 높은 운동, 예술, 학업 모든 면에서 뛰어난 학군을 만든 그 사례를 이야기를 하고 있어요. 그래서 이런 거의 사회실험 같은 완벽한 학군의 장점과 단점을 분석을 해본 결과를 이 책에 썼는데요. 굉장히 흥미로운 내용이었습니다.
Okay, so one of the stories in your book reminded me of, ironically, real estate market in Korea. In Korea, there is this concept that we call 학군지, which literally translates to the school district land. And those lands are at a premium because a lot of Korean parents put premium on academics. Korean parents do believe that where you go to school determines your academic success for the rest of your life. That belief is so strong that some parents go so far as going into huge amount of debt or, you know, invest their entire life saving in order to get even a tiny apartment in the good school district so their children will have a leg up in the academic competition, coming academic competition for college entrance. This has been controversial because other parents say that these 학군지s are actually not very good for kids because of the pressure that they put on kids might be detrimental to them developing as well-rounded individuals, or some people simply think it's not worth the money. In your book, you describe an American equivalent of the 학군지, where parents sort of gathered and built a perfect school district community where everybody excelled in academics and athletics, and you explore the dark side of these neighborhoods. What are some of the dark sides of having a neighborhood where the people, where the culture is for academic excellence and academic excellence only?
Well, the dark side is that what you have created is a monoculture. And a monoculture is a culture with a common set of values and aspirations and goals. And that can sound at the surface to be very appealing, particularly if the goals and aspirations are ambitious and, you know, about a high achievement. But for the children, for the kids who are in that world, a monoculture, first of all, creates a single standard for success, which means that anyone who doesn't meet that single standard feels like a failure, as opposed to a diverse culture where there are multiple pathways towards success. And secondly, monocultures are, you know, we know from nature, whenever we see nature, monocultures in nature, they are highly susceptible to epidemics because a single pathogen can sweep through a monoculture without any kind of, you know, genetic resistance. Right, a country with an enormous amount of genetic diversity is very resistant to being wiped out by an epidemic because there's so much kind of inherent variation in the makeup of the population. Same is true for a community that all follows the same rules or preaches the same values is going to be highly susceptible to any kind of epidemic that preys on that set of values. And so I describe this town, which was the embodiment of what your 학군지, the classic American 학군지, is this town called Poplar Grove, which is a made-up name, but the perfect upper-middle-class suburb with incredible schools and a close-knit community that everyone wants to live in. And they've had a problem with teenage suicide, an epidemic of teenage suicide that they can't shake. It's been going on for almost 10 years. And the reason for that is just what I'm talking about, that because all of the students are following the same pathway, they're all susceptible to the same feeling of inadequacy if they fail.
And that actually sounds like an East Asian society in general in miniature.
No, I know that has been an ongoing issue in many Korean schools. Yeah, it is exactly a version of what you have seen in your own country.
우리는 흔히 독일과 일본을 비교하면서 일본인들은 2차 세계대전 때 본국이 저지른 일에 대해서 웬만하면 함구하려고 하지만 독일은 그것을 인정하고 아이들한테도 가르치고 사죄를 한다라는 식으로 대조해서 이야기하는 경우가 많습니다. 근데 사실 독일도 1978년 이전까지는 2차 세계대전 때 저지른 일에 대해서 웬만하면 이야기를 하지 않는 분위기였고 독일과 맞서 싸운 미국 같은 나라의 역사가들도 이거를 중요하게 다루지 않았다고 합니다. 심지어는 독일에서 집단 학살 수용소에서 살아남아서 미국으로 이민 와서 살고 있는 유대인 단체들도 여기에 대해서 웬만하면 얘기를 하지 않았다 그래요. 그래서 이 사건은 역사 속에서 잊혀질 뻔했는데 1978년에 NBC가 홀로코스트를 반영하면서 그거를 본 젊은 독일 사람들이 30년 전에 이런 일이 있었다고 충격을 받으면서 교육제도와 역사책에 이 내용을 집어넣기 시작했다는 내용이 나와요. 그래서 말콤 글래드웰은 정말 잊혀지면 안 될 일들이 일어났을 때 역사 속에서 어떤 상황에선 이것이 기억되고 어떤 상황에선 잊혀지는지를 티핑 포인트라는 프레임을 통해서 설명을 하는 내용이 있었습니다.
I think the lesson of that chapter about the Holocaust is that, and I think it applies generally to any war where something morally horrendous is done to another group. It's very difficult for human beings to find the words and the emotion to talk about what happened. It's very hard for victims, it's very hard for victimizers. And it's hard for a number of reasons. One is that there is shame and guilt attached to it, but also because these events are outside of our normal imagination. And so in the absence of a kind of way of speaking about it, the default position is that they won't be spoken about. And I think we had this notion that if something is horrible, by definition, it will be remembered. No, the opposite is true. If something is truly horrendous, chances are it won't be remembered. And so the only way that these exceptional events get memorialized is if somebody goes to kind of heroic attempts to make that story meaningful to the rest of society, to make it relevant, to make it legible. And that happened in the Holocaust. The Holocaust was something that seemed like it was destined to be forgotten. And finally, 30 years after the war, there's a television show called The Holocaust, which is something that came from Hollywood. And it was finally put that experience in a form that people could make sense of and talk about.
Another powerful idea from your book is what you call local area variation. So the way I thought about this was in relation to what I do. And what I do here in South Korea is I create content that compares the American culture and the Korean culture, or, you know, try to find the messages from the American culture, like your book, that might be relevant to understanding things in Korea. And I actually started wondering at a certain point why cultural differences should exist at all anymore. Because back in 1990s, when I first went to the US to study, it was fairly obvious why cultural differences should exist. I mean, the TV programs were completely different. I grew up watching Japanese-style animes and K-pop, whereas American kids grew up watching Looney Tunes and MTV. And if you turned on the news, Korean news channels would cover completely different world issues than the American news channels. So we were fed different stories, which would lead to us having different value systems, which would lead to different cultures. So that was fairly obvious why there were cultural differences. But now, you know, like my niece watches, they're on the same platform as the sons and daughters of my American friends. They're all on YouTube and Instagram. And you'd imagine with culture being a sort of epidemic that at a certain point, everybody would be following the same celebrities, you know, wearing the same clothes, shopping at the same brands. But that's not happened. In fact, I feel that the trend has moved, if anything, further apart between different cities than before. So I found this idea of local area variation really interesting in terms of like where the frontiers of the epidemics end.
So local area variation is an idea that comes from people who study healthcare, medicine. And when you look, it's been studied very closely in the United States, but I think it's generally true in the developed world, that when you look at how medicine is practiced, you compare one city to the next, even cities that are side by side, you see striking differences. So you, in ways that make no rational sense. Mm-hmm. So the most famous early study on local variation was done in the state of Vermont. And the researcher was looking at two adjoining small towns that were probably 10 miles apart and found astonishing differences in, you know, how often you got your tonsils out or how many hysterectomies were performed or the likelihood of somebody getting their gallbladder taken out or whatever. It didn't matter what it was. You saw differences that made no sense. By virtue of where they lived, the communities in which they practiced, they performed medicine in a very different way. That's called local area variation. And over the last 25 years, what we've observed is that these trends have not gone away. They've seemed to even become more pronounced in the United States. I mean, so these differences are real. And what my argument is, I think that's true not just of healthcare, but it is a feature of the modern world that is growing, not shrinking. That even as we seem to participate in a common, even as it seems like certain kinds of international borders and cultural barriers are being broken down, the differences that divide or mark one community to the next are growing, not shrinking. Everybody thought in the 1960s and 70s in the United States that regional differences were going to disappear with mass media. And as you point out, the opposite happened. Regional differences are almost more pronounced than ever right now. Mm-hmm. So this is the paradox of the modern world, that even as we've established these kinds of international platforms, and even as culture has started to cross borders, differences have grown more pronounced. You can't make sense of people's decisions and behaviors, particularly communities' decisions and behaviors, without kind of grappling with the fact that there seems to be a kind of group consensus that directs the way we behave and that kind of hovers over the communities we live in. That there is something, to being from Seoul or being from London or even being from a particular neighborhood in one of those cities, mm-hmm. that shapes the way the residents of those areas behave. And they may not be aware of it, but it's real. Mm-hmm. That we have as human beings, in other words, a kind of acute sensitivity to the kinds of common shared assumptions that are kind of in the air in the communities we move in. That's what I call the overstory. And I don't think we pay enough attention to those overstories and how they change over time. We're, as human beings, I've always, in all my writing, going back to the very beginning, I've always argued that human beings are far more sensitive to the world outside of. We're far less inner-directed and far more outer-directed than we realize. And this is an expression of that belief.
I think that's an idea that's very easy for most East Asian readers to accept. We talk about this in Japanese, Korean, and Chinese. We have the same word, bunwigi, which means the temperature of the air that surrounds you, roughly translated.
In Korean, how would that be translated?
Bunwigi. So, for example, for a Korean person, it's very natural that I would behave in Seoul in a specific way because everybody dresses in a specific way or address each other in a specific way. And then, for example, when I go to New York, I take a whole different set of wardrobes. And within 2 days, I try to change the way I greet people, or usually louder and, looking at them directly in the eye. And the idea that you have to adapt to air of the community where you go to, I think it's very natural to our culture. With the research you've done for the book, do you believe that the human being, that idea that Americans have that they're masters of their own destiny and their decisions are entirely their own, have you come to find that that's not really true?
Oh, I've long believed it isn't true. I think if I had to vote as to which of these two worldviews, the Korean one or the Western one, the Asian one or the Western one is more accurate, I would say overwhelmingly the Asian one. I think the Western notion of the kind of individual is someone firmly in command of themselves and inner directed as opposed to being outer directed is it's a useful illusion, but it's an illusion. It's not real. You only reach that conclusion if you systematically ignore the real roots of your own behavior.
I just have one last closing question about a very moving and haunting line that I read in your book, your new book, that I think sort of summarizes what you're trying to say in the book. You quote I forget now whether it was an Irish or a Scottish poet who said, "If I can write songs of a nation, I don't care about its laws." Could you tell us in what context that was originally said and what you took it to mean and why you put it in the book?
This was a kind of Scottish philosopher who was saying that he's basically saying you can tell more about a culture, about a country, from its culture than its politics. That art defines a country's, a community's art defines that community in a way that the kind of formal expressions of its government do not. And I think that is profoundly true. And over the course of doing this book, it reinforced that notion in my head. Why do the stories that Hollywood tells matter? They matter because they're a window into what Americans think, right? About what they believe, about the way they see the world. And, you know, if you go around the world, you're right. It is Hollywood movies that tell people what America is. Right? It's exactly that point. It's not, I don't think people look at Donald Trump, for example, and say that's what America is. They look at Donald Trump and they say, that's what Donald Trump is, right? That's what some, they don't, that's not how you form your, but when you watch 50 Hollywood movies, that's how you form your sense of what matters in American culture. And I think, you know, there's something kind of profound and very beautiful in that. I'm a big car lover. I have a German car, a Korean car, and until very recently, a Japanese car. And, you know, I could make that argument about, you know, if I know the cars a country makes, I care not about its laws. Same kind of thing. My Kia tells me a lot about Korea, and my BMW tells me a lot about Germany. You know, in kind of interesting, and it's why there's very little politics in my writing, and particularly in this book. I just don't think it's as useful as we think it is in trying to explain, trying to understand the specifics of an individual culture.
결국 이 책의 중심적인 내용은 주류와 비주류의 관계를 통해서 역사의 사이클을 이해하자는 것 같습니다. 대부분의 경우 뭐 예를 들어서 100명 중에 한 사람이 특이한 생각을 한다 그러면 우리는 에이 쟤는 이상한 사람이야 또는 쟤는 뭐 속된 말로 또라이야 이러면서 그 사람을 무시하죠. 20명이 그럴 때도 마찬가지일 수 있어요. 22명이 그럴 때도 심지어는 마찬가지래요. 그런데 25명이 되면은 갑자기 저런 생각을 할 수도 있겠는데 라고 주류의 의견이 바뀌기 시작한다는 얘기를 합니다. 지난 10년 동안 우리 사회에서 있었던 이 격동의 경제, 사회, 정치에 대한 생각의 변화들이 사실 아예 없던 생각이 아니라 18%, 20%, 22% 정도의 사람들은 끊임없이 하고 있던 생각이었는데 그것이 25%가 되면서 갑자기 우리는 세상의 근간이 바뀌었다라고 느낄 수도 있다는 점이 이 책의 포인트였던 것 같고요. 또 하나는 주류가 주류성을 유지하기 위해서 받는 스트레스도 있고 비주류가 비주류이기 때문에 받는 이 토큰이라는 단어를 통해서 묘사되는 스트레스도 있기 때문에 주류와 비주류가 어떻게 하면은 같이 잘 살아갈 수 있고 이런 변화를 좀 더 유연하게 받아들일 수 있는지를 고민해야 앞으로 우리가 겪고 있는 이런 큰 격동을 조금이라도 줄이고 살아갈 수 있지 않을까라는 깊은 생각을 하게 해주는 책이어서 오늘 소개해봤습니다. 오늘 조승연의 탐구생활은 여기서 마무리하고요. 다음번엔 더 재밌는 역사 문화 이야기로 찾아뵙겠습니다. 안녕히 계십시오.